Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I have had my coffee and I'm ready to teach. So, today we're going to be dealing with Middle English. We've moved on, we're into the High Middle Ages now, the time of chivalry, of crusades, of the Black Death, and of various other nasty things, and feudalism and so forth. But this isn't about history. And in fact, all of those things we're oversimplifying massively. So let's move on to the language. Okay, today we're going to talk about Middle English. We're going to talk about the sources. We're going to talk about the spelling. We're going to talk about the sounds. And then we're going to get on to everyone's favorite part, morphology. And we're going to talk about what's changed in the morphological system of Middle English from Old English. If you want a good source on Middle English that's independent of the textbook that we're using, this book by Horobin and Smith, for which the reference is given at the end of the slides, is also a good place to look for a little bit more detail, though still at an introductory level. Okay, so what do we see happening during this period? Well, the main change involves the circumstances in which we find the language. So this is the period in which England becomes a literate society. We have from Anglo-Saxon England in total, now remember this is from the year 450 to the year 1150, 2,000 or so writs and charters, and then from the 13th century alone we have tens of thousands. So the amount of material that's available to us for studying the Middle English period has just ballooned at this point. It's enormous. Before 1300, the status of the language also changes during the Middle English period. So particularly before 1300, English is not seen as a prestigious language. And in fact, it needs defending. So when people use English, especially in the early Middle English period, they usually have to say why they're using English. It's a bit like if you were to write your exam script in Schwäbisch or something, right? You'd have to justify your choice, at the very least. And people justify their choice of using English before 1300. What happens after 1300 is that we don't see as much of that. We don't see people needing to justify their choice of language. I don't need now to justify my choice of language in speaking English to you. And people in England wouldn't think twice about using the language in literature, in on Facebook, anywhere else. So after 1300 is the time when English becomes a language of prestige, or at least a language which is an all-purpose language, a multifunctional language, a language that can be used in all domains. Because after 1300, what we see is English re-emerging. It re-emerges in literature. We start getting literary texts produced in English. We start getting courtly texts, legal texts produced in English, also church religious texts. Now, remember, during the Old English period, people used English for that. But the Norman Conquest did change things somewhat, such that English was mostly no longer the language of these high functions. The language of the high functions would have been either Latin or Anglo-Norman once again. It's easy to overstate this gap. It's not really the case that everything went dark for two centuries and then came back. But it's certainly true that there is less material produced during this intervening period. So the history of English, after Old English, things get quiet, not completely dead, but quiet. And then after 1300, things start to emerge again. The scene starts to explode with all kinds of new writing. I've got a little timeline at the bottom of the slide here. The famous date, 1066, you all know. 1244, so nearly two centuries after that, it becomes illegal to hold land in both France and England. This is important because the nobility, until this time, were very much a sort of jet-setting nobility. They had domains both in France and in the British Isles, and they would use both. They would be ruling over both. The notion of a separate England at this point, and in fact until a bit later, is really actually rather dubious. In 1258, then, so this is nearly 200 years after the Norman conquest, Henry III uses both English and French in an official context. This also was unusual at the time because these kings, remember the Anglo-Saxon kings, the kings of Wessex, Alfred and his descendants, those guys used English just fine. But after the Norman conquest, we have essentially 500 years of monarchs whose ties to the continent, whose ties to France, are just as strong as the ties to England. And so it's quite a milestone at this point in 1258 when King Henry III uses English as well as French. In 1349, this is a time when there are only two universities in the British Isles. This is the one that I didn't go to. I think it's less good for obvious reasons, but the University of Oxford, very old, at least we can say that for it. And English was first used there in 1349. So before that, again, the first university on British soil and the language that was used there was not English. And it takes until 1362, this is nearly 300 years after the Norman conquest, for Edward III to open Parliament in English. So we see during this period, the 13th and 14th centuries, that English is expanding its domain. It's starting to claw back some territory from those higher status languages, Latin and Anglo-Norman French. And this, obviously, this distribution has its reflections in the sources and the spelling of the language. So what do we have from the Middle English period? I've already hinted at the fact that we have absolutely loads of charters and legal documents, but we actually have all kinds of things. So we have all of the kind of stuff that we had from the Old English period and then some. So we have medicinal handbooks, recipes, sermons, saints' lives, even scientific works, and to an extent, poetry. These are all things that we find in both Old English and Middle English. But we start to find some new things in the Middle English period. For instance, plays. The first real plays written in the English language come from the Middle English period. Songs. We have extensive records of songs. We have accounts of travel. That also we have in the Old English period, I should say. But romances, and particularly letters, this is the real, we start towards the end of the Middle English period to get letters. And letters are absolutely great for linguistic purposes, because they give you one thing that almost no other document type gives you, which is the language of people who were not professional writers, essentially. These letters are written by people to other people. They were literate, of course, if they were doing the writing or they were doing dictation. But in any case, the language of these letters is often very interesting, especially since, and we'll see this when we talk more about the letters, so we get some people represented in these letters who otherwise are very, very underrepresented up until this point. Remember that we've come all the way to the Middle English period now. We've come hundreds of years, and we have yet to see a single text that's written by a woman. Right? Every single thing here has been written by men. Right? Usually in this monastic context. When we get letters, we start to expand the range of writers. And that's really interesting because it gives us a broader perspective on the language. It gives us a broader perspective on what we can know about language. And if it's not exactly the spoken language of ordinary people, it can at least be said to come closer. Okay, so some major works that we see from this period. There's quite a variety here. So we've got on the top left here, this is a very interesting text. This is a rare early Northern text, Middle English, early Northern Middle English, the Ormulum, written by a guy called Orm. And Orm was very inventive because Orm wrote his, Orm essentially designed his own spelling system for the English language. Remember that there was a certain lack of transmission. There was a certain extent to which the sort of the literary practices of the Anglo-Saxon world were forgotten during the early Middle English period. So Orme has to basically come up with a writing system for English all on his own, and he does a very interesting job. So this is an interesting text from all kinds of perspectives, also a very early text. And we have fewer texts from the early part of the Middle English period. Remember that we're dealing with 1150 to 1500 here. 1150 to 1300, we have comparatively little. But beyond that, 1300 to 1500, we have absolutely tons of stuff. That's Ormulum. Another early text here, Layamon's Brut, is a beautiful manuscript, actually. We get in the Midlands, anyway. We'll talk more about dialects next time. We're going to cover syntax, the lexicon, and dialects. But this one is a Midlands text, relatively early, Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. And here, this is a close-up of this story, right? And if this picture, you may think, well, I'm not sure what's going on here, because it looks like this green guy on a horse is holding his own severed head. If you're thinking that, then that is indeed what is happening in this picture. Right. This is a very interesting story from that perspective. Worth taking a look at for literary reasons, if you're interested in that kind of thing. The other main person who has been seized upon for literary reasons from the Middle English period is Chaucer, and we have a Chaucer manuscript down here. Chaucer is we have writers in the earlier period like Alfrich and Wulfstan who were relatively productive. Chaucer was very clearly an absolutely amazing and very prolific writer. So we have all kinds of stuff from Chaucer, and at this time, this is where, on the whole, things really start to get interesting from a literary perspective. Mostly literary scholars are fairly disparaging or dismissive about what comes out of the Old English period. That's not universally the case. Beowulf, for instance, is everyone recognizes as a great work of literature. But there is very little fiction from the early period, very little of what you might think of as creative writing. Whereas here, when we get to the Middle English period, we have loads, as we have loads of everything else. And then down here, finally, a letter. This is a Paston letter. These letters by the Paston family are some of the earliest letters that we have. And as I say, they're very interesting because they reveal different perspectives from different kinds of people. Not people in a monastic context, crucially. So these are also fascinating from a linguistic perspective. Also, they give you a great insight into daily life, into the actual experiences, the lived experiences of people in this period. And there is more. You can see I've given you a brief list here of what there is. We've got stuff ranging from the 12th century to the 15th century, things like the York plays, still performed on occasion. We've got the works of Wycliffe. We've got works that were considered extremely problematic and even heretical in their time. We've got works from these ones, the Catherine group, show more continuity with Old English. So they come from the monastic context. They have things like saints' lives in them. And then we have more poetry, like Cursa Mundi and Piers Plowman. And the earliest Arthurian legends. So across Europe, we get this flowering of the genre of knightly romance, tales of chivalry. And this text, the Morte d'Arthur, is one of the ones that that emerges by Mallory. It was one of the ones that emerges during this period. And most of the present-day stories about King Arthur and his knights, the Knights of the Round Table, ultimately have their origins in either this text or the texts, the French texts from the continent that were being written at about the same time. If you want to know more about the texts, not only is there a section in the textbook, but also you can go to this website, luminarium.org, and this has a whole array of Middle English texts that you can browse to your heart's content. Does anyone have any questions? Good, so those are the major works in the Old English period. What about spelling then? Well, early texts in Middle English keep some of the idiosyncrasies of Old English spelling. So the early texts retain things like ash, retain the yog, retain the thorn, and retain the eth. But three of these symbols, the ash, the thorn and the eth, disappear relatively early in the period. So here you can see Layamon's Brut, which is a late 13th century text, and you can see that it's still got some of these in it. It's still got, so here you've got an eth that remains. There is a thorn, I believe there is one here, and down here as well. So these symbols are retained for quite a long time, up until the late 13th century. They're not lost yet, but they do, after this period, after the 13th century, these symbols tend to disappear. And the first ones to go are the ash and the eth. They just get replaced by a on the one hand, and th, on the other hand, or thorn. And thorn is the last one to survive. So thorn survives for the longest. And before the thorn is replaced, it takes up a very special shape. So let's see if I've got any chalk. So the thorn, a normal thorn, an Old English thorn, the runic thorn, looks like this. It's pointy, right? And remember, there's a good reason that the runic symbols are pointy. They're pointy because you've got to carve them with a knife or with a sharp implement. So that's the runic thorn. When you get into the Old English thorns that we see in texts, they'll often look a bit more like this. In connected texts that aren't runic, that are written in the Roman alphabet, thorn looks like this. Later thorn, starts to look a bit more like this. So first of all, it's bulging at the top a bit. Secondly, something rather different happens to this thorn, which is that people stop connecting it at the top. So if you rub that off, hate chalk dust. So you get, anyway, the point is, what you get is something that looks a little bit like a backwards Y. And this has had an effect. So even in quite late Middle English texts, you still have a thorn, but it looks like this, right? It looks like this weird Y. And so if you go to places that are trying to look old-fashioned in English, you will see them written like a bit like this, right? Ye oldie shoppy, or ye oldie castle, or something, right? Now, this is a complete, I won't say it's a complete lie, but at least it's something that's very ridiculous, because this word would never have been pronounced ye, right? So this is the definite article, and it would never have been pronounced ye. It would always have been pronounced the or th, right? The. This is just the word the, and it always was. But because it looked like a Y, people have taken to writing it in later texts, in modern texts, like a Y. So that's why you see this ye olde thing, right? It's a sort of anachronism that arises during this Middle English period. Well, one thing that's very clear is that in this period, each text is unique. In Old English, we have a very comparatively homogeneous set of texts. You know, they're all made in these monastic, in these few, probably almost all of the Old English we have comes from four or five monastic centers, and those monastic centers had their own writing traditions. We can't really call them standard languages. We're going to come on to standard languages in 2 weeks' time, but we can say that they had common practices. Of course they did. But in the Middle English period, we have so many more documents from so many more places, written by so many more people, that we can really see a huge variety. I mean, just comparing these two manuscripts makes that very clear, right? That here you've got, this script is very, very neat, right? It may look a little bit alien, but once you get used to it, you can read it very, very neatly. Look at how it lines up very nicely. Everything is written on neat lines. You've got a few ascenders going above the line, a few descenders going below the line. But on the whole, this script is really, really neat and tidy. Here we've got one of the letters. Now, this is a completely different type of script, right? And even if you know what, even if you can read Middle English fluently, it's still a challenge to make out what these texts are actually saying, because of the writing system. Some of them it's quite clear. So we've got here, looks like an of my, for instance. That's fine. But it's not all clear, right? This is not a one of these beautiful, clearly written texts produced in a traditional scriptorium. So this is just an example of what different types of text can look like. And at the very end of the period, at the very, very end of the period, we get something else, which is the printing press. We get printed texts emerging. We're not going to talk about that today. Again, we're going to come back to that in 2 weeks' time when we talk about the early Middle English period. Because most of the Middle English texts, the vast majority, are traditional manuscripts, which still would have been written, for the most part, on vellum in the traditional way, same as in the Old English period. So what else changes? Well, for a start, some of the special symbols drop out of the language, but there's more. And some of these changes are probably due to French scribal influence. So first of all, the Old English CW would be replaced by QU. Now, the Q is something that you almost never find in Old English texts. This really emerges during this Old English, during this Middle English period. Q for CW. So, for instance, this is the Old English word. This is an Old English word, quain. What's this the word for? Yep. Queen, yeah. So this gets replaced, QU, and this is a long E, and so this gets written QUEEN. And that illustrates something else, which is that double vowels start to be used to mark long vowels at this point. So for instance, Queen, which in Old English there is no vowel length marking, or at least very rarely is there vowel length marking. In the Middle English period, we start to get double vowels being used for vowel length. So Old English bork, which was a long vowel, that would still have been pronounced bork in the early Middle English period, but the or became written as two letters to illustrate the length. Now, this This word changes in the Middle English later on to be pronounced book, but it would still have been pronounced book at this point. And you can still find speakers of English who say book. Right? They still exist. The other thing to note here is that this C has turned into a K. So we've got a C becoming a K. And in fact, C, the letter C does a lot of work in the Old English period. But in the Middle English period, we find that it gets replaced. When it's palatalized, when it's in Africa, it becomes ch, ch. When it becomes, it sometimes is retained as C, and it's sometimes retained as K. And in modern English orthography, the distinction between C and K is not always particularly clearly phonologically motivated. But K in general, again, like Q, K is something that you don't see that often in the Old English manuscripts. It does crop up every now and then, and it's much more common on the continent in Old Saxon. But in Old English, we don't see it very much. So different scribal traditions. Remember, these changes, these are not sound changes, right? The sound of the language is not changing here. What's changing is the spelling. And the spelling can change independently of the sound for various reasons. Here, we're probably dealing with French scribal influence. What else do we have here? We have HW being replaced by WH, or simply W. So the famous word, first word of Beowulf. What? Meaning what? The ash gets lost and replaced by A. The HW switches round in the writing. It's still pronounced the same. And this word becomes what? Well, same pronunciation, but modern spelling. And the vowel, that changes later. That is the quality of the vowel. As I've said, thorn and ev disappear and get replaced by the modern th. Sc gets replaced by sh. So, for instance, the word ship, which was written with an sc, in the Old English period, ship gets replaced and gets its modern spelling, S-H-I-P. Another interesting one. This is very clearly a case of French influence. Long U gets written as O-U. Is this, and U. Still written with this spelling, which you don't find at all in the old period, but is all over the place in the middle period. We'll see some examples in a second. Finally, then, on the spelling, Old English H, the Old English letter H does a lot of work. It's standing in for a whole lot of different sounds. You start at this point getting both yog and y introduced to replace the h and the palatalized g in words like the word night. In Middle English texts, in Old English texts, night is written n-i-h-t, and it would have been nicht or nicht. Depending, we don't know exactly the quality of the vowel there, of the consonant there. Might have been more palatal, might have been more velar, might have been more like a h, might have been more like a h. That gets written like this, which eventually later changes into the modern spelling. What's important is that during this period, this symbol, the yog symbol, gets an independent identity. It sort of branches out on its own. So this is the only symbol left that is kind of weird from a modern English perspective. All of the others have disappeared by the late Middle English period, but the yog becomes becomes separate. It becomes a grapheme in its own right. So in Old English, you do have this symbol, this yog symbol, but it's just, so it's this thing here, the yog, and it's just, this is just how the Old English scribes write G, right? So it's just their version of G in these old texts. Middle English, later Middle English is different, because in later Middle English you have G and you also have yog. So you have both of these symbols. That's the important point here. Yog takes on a life of its own during the Middle English period. Ends up being relatively short-lived. It doesn't really survive even into the early modern English period. But Middle English is the age of the yog. Do we have any questions about the spelling system? No? Okay, good. We'll move on and talk now about the actual sounds. When talking about Middle English, there's a lot of variation, but it's very important to bear in mind the difference between spelling change and sound change. Spellings are not sounds, and sounds are not spellings. And spelling can change independently of sound, and vice versa. So when you look at a word that looks weird in Middle English, you have to figure out why it looks weird. Does it just look weird because it was spelled differently, or does it look weird because it was pronounced differently? That is always a crucial question here. You need to keep phonology and orthography very clearly separate. So here's an overview of the Middle English sound system. These are the sounds that existed in Middle English. The consonants, this is the set of consonants, and if you look back and compare this, you can compare what we've said today to what we said in lecture 3 about Old English. This consonant system is actually exactly the same. So there are the overall consonants that exist in the English language are precisely the same in Middle English as they were in Old English. There is one very important difference. And that difference is that the voiced fricatives are now phonemically distinct. So previously, we can see in this column here, in the fricative column, we've got an F and a V, F and V, F and V, S and Z, H and R. And they're distinguished only by the voicing, right? By vocal fold activity. There are voice sounds. In Old English, you might remember, these are not distinct phonemes. They occur in different positions in the word. They're in what's called complementary distribution. They're allophones of the same phoneme. And you find the V phoneme between two voiced sounds. You find the V allophone, crucially, the V allophone between two voiced sounds and the F elsewhere. So if you have a word like Hiervon, this is pronounced as a voiced sound, as a V. In the Old English period, this is pronounced as a V, even if it's written as a F. Why? Because it's between two vowels, right? Two voiced sounds. So in the Old English period, voiced fricatives were not phonemically distinct from voiceless fricatives. They were just two allophones of the same phoneme. And it's said that the voiced fricatives becoming phonemically distinct is an influence of French. It's because a lot of French loanwords come in. If you want to figure out whether two sounds are allophonically distinct or phonemically distinct, what you need is a minimal pair. So we know in English, we can take words like sip and zip. So sipping is something that you do to drink, maybe a hot drink or a soup. Zip, a zip is something that goes on a piece of clothing. It goes zzz, zzz. These two words are the only thing that distinguishes these two words is the voicing on the fricative. So this is a voiceless S, and this is a voiced one Z. And that is what distinguishes this pair of words. In Old English, there were no minimal pairs like this, which meant that these two sounds could not be conceived of as phonemically distinct. These were purely in complementary distribution. But in Middle English, that all changes, and we get words that are distinguished in meaning by their fricative voicing, just as we do today. So those are the consonants. Hopefully that's clear enough. When we move on to the vowels, what we see now, and the vowels that are marked in green on this slide, are the ones that are new. They haven't come from nowhere, though. What's actually happened here is that we've moved from a system in which the main thing that is used is vowel length. So remember, in Old English, vowels could be long or short. So you could have e or e. You could have e or e. And the distinction there was a quantitative distinction. One of the vowels was a longer version of the other. But the main distinction in Middle English starts to be quality rather than just length. And so we start to get different sounds emerging. Alongside e, we have e. Alongside e, we have e. Alongside u, we have u. So we've got the beginnings of the modern English tense lax distinction in our vowel system. And so you can see that basically there's a few pairs of vowels here, one of which is they're written as it's written as a height difference that in some cases might probably slightly misleading. You can see there are many more quality distinctions, many more vowel quality distinctions in the Middle English system than there were in the Old English system. Now, obviously, because vowel quality is something that is bloody hard to represent in writing, we don't actually know exactly when this happened, but we can still, the best evidence that we have suggests that it's during the Middle English period that this change happens, that the vowels start to be distinguished more by quality than by quantity. Something that's disappeared, the only thing that's really disappeared from this system, is the rounded front vowel, u. So u is a sound that is retained in languages like French, also in German, in words like über. These words, this sound is lost. It just merges with the unrounded counterpart. So the only difference between this sound in the top left corner, e, and its counterpart, ü, is lip rounding. So you can read someone's lips to figure out whether they're rounding the vowel or not. I, ü, I, ü. And the ü sound is simply lost by unrounding. It's unrounded into e. We get that particular vowel being lost. Then there's another vowel that comes in, a new diphthong. And the new diphthong is an oi sound, o, oi. And that, again, comes in through French borrowings. What we see here, interestingly, is that the French influence seems to affect the phonology of the language to some extent. So all of these borrowings from French, some of which have sounds that previously weren't used in English or maybe weren't phonemic in English, and that leads to a sort of a change in the overall phonological shape of the language. So that's the general sound system. And there are a few specific sound changes that can also be discussed. The first of these is H dropping. So this is something that's very much associated with the modern language. So for instance, for the word house, you'll get speakers that say ouse. This is a common feature in modern day British English. It's quite a stigmatized feature still. But what's interesting about it is that we see it really, really early. We see it in Middle English. So here we have an example. Ich habe, right? This is ich habe, right? But in its English form, but we still expect to see ich habe. But in this context, the H gets dropped. So all we see is ich habe. Ich habe im in Kasseln 7000 Kämpfen. 7000 fighters. So we see the H being dropped there. And we see the H being dropped in other contexts where it wouldn't be dropped today. So these changes don't always stick, but we know that the process was going on. So we have in the next line, "But ihr wollt ein Glade at an Uhr in his Licht." An Uhr is an hour, right? We would expect to see an H on the front of it. So the dropping of H is something that starts in Middle English. There is one context in which it always takes effect. And that is in consonant clusters. So Old English has consonant clusters that begin with a ch. So we see in Old English, chlaf, and that becomes just laugh, which eventually becomes loaf, right? A loaf of bread. We see chrador becoming rather, where the gets dropped off the front. So the H is always lost in Middle English in consonant clusters, and we see it also being lost in other positions, but not always consistently. The syllable final voiceless fricative, ch, this is lost at the end of a syllable. So for instance, doctor, meaning daughter, this is daughter, the ch gets lost. So then it would be daughter, ancestor of modern English, daughter. Seach becomes just sea, the ancestor of modern English, saw. Knicht, so knicht is the Middle English for a knight, and this word obviously changes its form enormously, so that ch sound disappears. W then, the W gets lost between consonants and back vowels. And what's interesting about this change is that sometimes it's represented in the spelling and sometimes it's not. So for instance, in the case of swa, which is Old English for so, the W disappears. So then this becomes saw, swa to saw. We get swilk, such, losing its W. And becoming such. We get toi, the word for two. So this would be toi, and then it just becomes you get a rounding, well, you get a raising and rounding, and you lose the vowel, so you get two in modern English. This is a word where you get a written W, but it's never, never pronounced. And this is the same in a word like sword. So we see in the Old English, sweort, which is pronounced with a W, sweort, but in modern English, it's not pronounced sword, right? It's pronounced sword. So it's always pronounced without the W after the S. So even though it's there in the spelling, it's lost in the pronunciation. And this is as early as the Middle English period. So the spelling varies here. The spelling varies to represent the same sound. Finally then, for the consonants that delete, another one that deletes is nasals and liquids in various contexts. So this word, huilum, meaning while, becomes huile. You get loss of the nasal and you get a schwa vowel here. Manchester becomes Manchester, so the M becomes an N, because the M and the N is easier to pronounce in this position before the ch, right? It's an assimilation process. The place of articulation of these two consonants comes together. And then you get some deletions. Swilch, we've already talked about what happens to the W, so then that becomes sulch, German solch. And then you get the L disappearing as well to give us just such, which becomes modern English such. And then we get more metathesis. So here we've got a nice example of the word bright, beocht, which becomes in Middle English, bricht, which then becomes modern English bright. So what's happened here is that the R and the vowel have swapped places. So those are the key consonant deletions and consonant-related changes that it's worth talking about now. Does anyone have any questions about those? Yes.
We have to
recognize the sound changes that you see. If you can, that would be great. Because this is hard, there won't be many points riding on it, right? So this is something to recognize consonant changes in Middle English, because it's quite tricky. If you can do it, great, and there will probably be a few little bits and pieces about that on the exam, yes. So then we've got this voiced alveolar fricative, a r, becoming a glide. This you can see very easily by comparing Old English with present day English. So Old English has the word bora, which would have been pronounced with this voiced fricative, and that becomes bow. The w is the most common outcome here. So, for instance, in the word fugol, which remember, this means bird, it is related to German vogel, this word, the g, becomes a w. So it becomes, from fugol, it becomes fuol, and that becomes the modern fowl. The only thing about this is that this modern word, fowl, is actually not used very much. In the modern language, fowl like this is only used to refer to certain kinds of bird. Particularly, you often see it in the context of waterfowl. Waterfowl are water birds, right? Things like ducks can be waterfowl. Sometimes fowl is also used to refer to chickens or turkeys or farm birds. So in these specific contexts, water birds and farm birds, you'll find the word fowl. But otherwise, it's mostly replaced by the word bird. So usually this G becomes a W. And we can also see this in words like Old English morgen, becoming present-day English morrow. Halgian, to hallow, that becomes hallow. So all of these words with G's end up as words with W's in the modern language. And that means that if a word like tomorrow, if you think about it, this is a direct cognate. It's directly related. If you were to say, for instance, in German, tomorrow is simply zu morgen, right? I know you don't say that, but you could if you wanted to. Maybe you should. Who knows? Okay, so most of the time, this W becomes, this G becomes a W in pronunciation. R becomes W. And we also see it becoming Y in certain contexts where high vowels are involved. So for instance, the words nail or nagel becomes a nail. Fair, fairer or fair becomes fair. So this voiced fricative becomes a glide in all contexts. Which glide it becomes depends on where in the word it's found. Finally, I think, finally for sound changes, the vowels do some interesting things too. So first of all, vowels change in length. And I'm not going to ask you about this on the exam because it would just be mean, because these vowels are absolutely horrible. Some of the vowels become long, some of the vowels become short, and in general, the whole system becomes a complete bloody mess. And so I will move swiftly on. One thing that's predictable is that before a voiced, a nasal or a voiced stop, Old English short vowels lengthen. Lamb or comb, so these start out as, so these become lamb and comb, which aren't retained, but they're pronounced like that in Middle English. The ones that are more interesting are mild and chilled, which are pronounced in the Old English as mild and chilled, and they become mild and chilled in the Middle English period. Mild, chilled, and then later they get their modern diphthongal pronunciation, mild, child. You get shortening before other clusters, and this gives some interesting vowel alternations. So for instance, in the verb keep, the Old English for keep was cape, and the past tense was capte, also with a long vowel, but this long vowel becomes a short vowel. So capte becomes kepte. So then you get this modern kept as a past participle, or past preterite. Some of the vowels change in height. Again, I'm not going to ask you in detail about that. The only one that's particularly worth noting is that long R raises to OR in Middle English. So this one raises to this one. So words in Old English like na, mast, ham, and Anna become no, most, home, and one. And in the Old English, in the Middle English period, these would have been pronounced as nor, most, home, and on. And this is something that we see in the written forms, but we only see it in non-Northern texts. So Northern texts retain the old vowel. And you can still see this every now and then in dialectal pronunciations today. What's confusing here is that the short A behaves in completely the opposite way. So short A, as in man and land, in the north becomes spelled as mon and lond with an O, but not in the south. So the A's and the O's start to switch round a bit. The long one raises in the south and the Midlands, but not in the north. So let's see some of this stuff in action. Here we've got Piers Plowman which is a poetic text from the 14th century from the West Midlands. One thing that's important to remember about the Middle English period is that we get texts from all over the place. And in fact, most of our texts in the Middle English period come from the Midlands. And that's very important because it means that the Middle English texts that we have are not necessarily direct continuations of the Old English. Remember that most of our Old English comes from the far south. It comes from Wessex. The Middle English is different. The Middle English comes from all over the place, but predominantly the Midlands. This is a West Midlands text. So we can see that the alliterative patterns are retained in this text. So remember that Old English poetry wasn't rhyming poetry, it was alliterative poetry. The first consonant has to match. So we have, in a sormer season, when soft was the sonne, I schope me en schrudes, as I a shape were. In a summer season when the sun was soft, I clothed myself in clothes, as if I was a sheep, for some reason. In habita as an eremita, unholy of workus, went weira in this world, wanderous to here, etc. So, weira here, we don't have any rounding anymore. It's written as a Y, but it would have been pronounced E as an unrounded vowel. And you can check this example in your own time for cases of the changes that we've just discussed. I'm going to move on now to the morphology, unless anyone has any questions. Yeah. How did the features become standardized? Good question, which I'm not going to answer because I'm going to spend quite a lot of time talking about that in 2 weeks. Okay? So the standardization is fascinating. What we have in the Middle English period is this amazing richness of different forms, huge variation. But then somehow that variation gets sort of boiled down to a manageable core, at least in the written language. And that happens during the early modern period predominantly in ways that we're going to discuss in 2 weeks' time. For now, quickly, the nominal morphology and the main thing to know about the nominal morphology of English, you'll be pleased to hear, is that in the Middle English period, it gets a hell of a lot simpler. So, let's look at these personal pronouns. We've still got a paradigm for personal pronouns, but when you look at these, they're not actually that dissimilar at all from what we find in the modern language. So, for instance, look at this bottom row, the third plural. They, them, there. First plural, we, us, our. There's nothing different going on here from what we see in the modern language. He, him, his, it. What we still retain, each up here, rather than just I, and we still retain something else. We still retain this thing, thou, thee, thine. And remember, we saw these already, and these are cognate with du, dir, and dein. In German. And actually what's very interesting is that these are singular forms and what happens is that in this system, in the Middle English system, we start to get them being used as they are in German, roughly, right? There are differences. But German and French both have this system where you have to decide when you're talking to someone whether you're going to call them du or call them sie. Right? This we have in German. English doesn't have it, which I think makes life a hell of a lot easier for people like me, except when I'm speaking German when it's a complete pain. The Middle English system works like a lot like the German system. So thou, which is the cognate of du, is the sort of familiar one, and ye, is the formal or polite variant. And I'm not going to talk about that in detail now, but if you look at Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, you find this being used in a very creative and interesting way to talk about the social relationships between the different characters in the story. Similarly, in the Arthurian legends, when you get, for instance, Gawain or Lancelot talking to King Arthur, they talk to him as ye. But he talks to them, he calls them thou, right? Thou. So there is a clear asymmetry between those two, right? Because the king is more important than everyone else, basically. Even though it's a round table, the king is still the boss. As you can see, there are some new pronouns here. Particularly, we've got they, them, there, we've got she. And we've got the dual, that's completely gone. Remember, we had a dual in Old English. In the Middle English period, other than the very, very earliest occasional examples, the dual is dead. So, no more dual. What about these new pronouns then? We can start with they, their, and them, because the usual story about these pronouns is that they come from Scandinavian. This is an artifact, we talked about this last time too, this is an artifact of influence from the Vikings and the Norse people who settled in the British Isles after that time. So up here, in the north, this is the late Middle English period, a map of England during the late Middle English period, so 1300 to 1500. In the north and the east, we find them, and in the south, for this object form, we find hem, the old form. Because remember, in Old English, the third person pronouns ended with started with H. And in early texts, that's what we see. And in south and western texts, that's what we see. But in the north and in the east, we find the them pronoun in this position. What about she? So that's they, there, and them. The usual story is that these come from Scandinavian. That has been questioned in recent years. But that is what most people say, at least, is that this thing is a Scandinavian borrowing. What about she? So in Old English, we don't find she, the pronoun she, with a sh at the beginning. And in Middle English, we start to find it. And what's interesting is that in Middle English, in Old English, there is a demonstrative, seo, or seo, that could plausibly be the ancestor of this pronoun she, especially since one variant that we very commonly find in the Middle English period is this one, sho. We find a lot of sho for she. In fact, we find huge amounts of variation. This is one of the great and terrible features of Middle English, spelling variation all over the place. So for this one pronoun, third person singular pronoun, there are over 30 variant spellings listed in the Oxford English Dictionary. So she, there's a she with a y on the end, sha with an a. To what extent these are really spelling variants and to what extent these are actually pronunciation variants, it's hard to tell. But it is clear that there must have been a pronoun that was pronounced something like sho, as well as the modern she. So this is a debated feature in the history of English. It also spreads from the north. So we find a lot of changes in this time spreading from the north. Remember that also the changes that lead to S in the verbs and in the nouns, they spread from the north as well. These pronouns come from the north and move south. The other thing that emerges during this time is reflexives. So pronouns like myself, yourself, himself, themselves. These pronouns also emerge during the Middle English period. We didn't have them in Old English. In terms of nouns and adjectives then, the picture is really simple, because basically in Middle English, at least by the late Middle English, by the time of poets like Chaucer and Gower, The nouns and the adjectives have basically lost pretty much everything that distinguishes them in terms of case and most of the number stuff as well. So nouns retain genitive es. So you still have a distinct genitive form, but almost nothing else. There is no distinct form for nominative or accusative or dative in the nouns. And what's also clear that I should have mentioned here is that in general, you can see this column in the middle here. By the early Middle English, by the late Middle English period, there is no distinction between the accusative and the dative anymore. These forms are merged completely, and they're not functionally distinct anywhere, not even in the pronoun paradigm. Adjectives, on the other hand, adjectives lose almost all of their endings. Sometimes you get this E ending retained, but it doesn't seem to have all that much of a function by this period, or at least the function varies by text. So again, if you see that ye old E, this E ending is just used to kind of to mark ancientness, to mark medievalness. And then, of course, one other development that happens is that this is the period where we get the word the. Every English speaker's favorite word, the, which is invariable. Nominative the, dative the, accusative the, genitive the, plural the. Beautiful. So, we've got a massive reduction in forms here. We've got almost all, remember the vast paradigms that you were probably despairing about in lecture three, these huge case paradigms, almost all of that complexity has been completely bulldozed by the point of these late Middle English texts. And so what we see is a change away from a synthetic type system towards a more analytic one. And that's a theme that we're going to come back to next time. So these are very dramatic changes that have taken place. The case system essentially reaches its modern state during the Middle English period. That is to say, there is a nominative versus non-nominative distinction in pronouns. There are some distinct genitive forms in pronouns as well, and at this point some in nouns, but otherwise everything's gone. The nouns don't do case anymore, and neither do adjectives. Okay, any questions about the nominal system? So now we will talk briefly about the verbal system, verbal morphology in English. And the verb agreement has changed. It hasn't changed as much as the nominal agreement, but it's still changed a fair bit. So this is the verb to find, and you can see that there are still a few different endings out there. So particularly in the plural, we've got an alternation between findeth and finden. We also still have a subjunctive, but the subjunctive is a little bit flaky at this point. During the Middle English period, the subjunctive starts to disappear. And having a separate subjunctive is no longer something that's very frequent in Middle English. So recall that in Old English, the subjunctive was used in irrealis contexts. It was used to mark, for instance, hypothetical situations, wishes, desires, counterfactuals. Those roles start to be filled by different elements during this period. So instead of having the subjunctive, we start to find other types of construction. We start to find modals. We start to find non-finite clauses. So, for instance, I want that he come with a subjunctive gets replaced during this period by a construction like, I want him to come, with no specification there. So the subjunctive is on its way out. It's not gone, but it starts to be used less commonly and in fewer contexts during the Middle English period. Already we find no person agreements in the plural. In the past, there is no plural agreement in the singular either. So at least for, these are the strong verbs. So we've got fond in the singular in all persons, and fund or funden in the plural. So here, mostly, we can see that we've got an N. What have we got left? We've got an N that sticks around as a plural marker. We've got this F. This F is being replaced by S. And this change takes a long time. And again, it spreads from the north. So these S changes come down from the north and from the east to take over the rest of the language. And finally, we've still got a distinct second person form. So thu findes or findest, either of those, still found. Note that these endings are for strong verbs. Weak verbs have some slight differences. So in weak verbs, we have the same in the present, but the past is slightly different. We have a de ending still, and dest. The d preterite form is still intact, and there is a separate second person singular form during this period. The past participle, what's interesting here is that you can see this is, remember in Old English, what we most commonly find in this slot is something that's written as GE, right? It's related to the German G, but it's pronounced in Old English as ye, and in Middle English it's retained, but it's written as an I or a Y, and it's just pronounced E. So here we've got ifunden, found, ifunden. So this Y, and this as it is in Old English, it is optional. So sometimes it's there and sometimes it's not. But it is still retained. And this Y in front of a participle is still found quite commonly during this period. Remember now that Old English had a clear distinction between strong verbs and weak verbs. So Old English had many strong verbs. It had a quite productive class of strong verbs. In the Middle English period, we have big, big changes afoot. Nearly a third of the Old English strong verbs are lost early in this period. So the verbs shift from strong to weak. This is the trend that we see throughout the English language. Interestingly, during this period, we have some variation. We see verbs like walk, to walk, in Middle English, can be either strong or weak. So we have the past form welk, right, in Chaucer, and we also have the past form walked in Chaucer. So the first one is strong with a vowel change, and the second one is weak with a dental ending. And we find both, so we find variation. Some of the verbs later do change. They later become weak, but in the Middle English period they're still strong. So for instance, to laugh, now in modern English is a weak verb, so we just say laugh, laughed. But in Middle English, you could say lure, or lache, with a vowel change. So strong, the verb to laugh was strong. Similarly, help. We have helped. I have helped him. In Middle English, I have holpen him, right? Like geholfen. So these verbs are still a lot of verbs. Not all of the verbs have switched to being weak. Not even the ones that are weak in present-day English. So this change is still underway. And sometimes strong and weak pairs get completely mixed up. And this is what happens with Old English duvan, to dive, and you have weak duvan, So you've got this is a minimal pair, duvan, duvan. And the strong form, duvan, becomes obsolete by 1300, it disappears. And what happens is that the weak form takes over, and it takes over its semantics as well. So duvan turns into divan, because remember that y becomes unrounded, so we've got divan, which later becomes diva, dive. It changes its meaning. So it no longer just means dip, it can also mean dive. So here we've got a case of a strong and a weak pair becoming conflated, and where the modern, where duvan, the weak form takes over. Some of you might have come across a modern strong past form, dove. So he dove into the water rather than he dived into the water. That actually comes back, it's later. So occasionally, you get weak verbs innovating new strong forms, and that's what we find here. But that's not very common in the history of English. Usually, we get strong forms becoming weak. So here we've got a nice example from Malory's Mort d'Arthur, which is a late 15th century text. This is a text from towards the end of the Middle English period. And one thing that you should hopefully find about a text like this is that it's relatively easy to understand. Right? Certainly when we compare it to something like the Layamon or Old English, this is pretty straightforward. In May, when every lusty heart flourishes and burgeons. We can see some of the features here of Middle English. The has emerged, right? No more complex inflecting demonstratives, just the. But we still see that there's still this F ending. The F ending, and we'll see later, will survive even into the early modern English period in some contexts. We see here is an infinitive ending, beholder, with an E. Here is a plural ending, man and woman, right? Conjoined subject, therefore plural, man and woman. Rejoicen, so in a plural with N. Here we've got this air. This air is the adjective ending on fresh. We don't know why it's there, but remember that it is sometimes still there. And finally we see the modern ES, this ES plural ending that we see throughout the modern English language. But we also see that there are some features, some older features, like this yog that is still retained down here. This is what English looks like towards when we come up to 1500, when we come up to the end of the Middle English period. It's starting to look much more recognizable now. Okay, does anyone have any questions about the verbal morphology or any other aspect of the morphology? Well, I'll let you read the summary for yourselves. For the exercise today, what I want you to do is exercise 4 in the textbook, and also there is a text for you to look at. This one is fun because you can go to this website and listen to it aloud. You can listen to someone pronouncing this text online. So have a look at this text and focus for this next tutorial on the morphology.